The quality of light here really is extraordinary and very different than what I know from the Midwest. And I've said to a couple of people that, first off, the kind of amber gold, sometimes pink quality that's in the Hudson River School paintings really does exist and really does happen often here. And there's something about the ecosystem of the river, I think, the latitude, maybe the particulate in the air, it's hard to sort of, you know, it's somewhat scientific, it's perceptual, but I have, it's a more of a kind of non-literal statement that I'm going to make, but I often feel like the light is coming at me from the side here.
This is The Conversation. It's episode 189 with Anne Lindberg. She is a Hudson River Valley-based artist. She's been there a little over 2 years and moved from Kansas City. So it's our first Hudson Valley artist, and we do talk about that. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the podcast is theconversationpod.com, where I highly recommend you check out Indeed. Anne supports her description of the light in the Hudson River Valley with some awesome images of the landscape, her home and barn, her studio barn, with incredible Hudson River Valley light. So go check those out, as well as images of her work and her special custom designed architectural drafting stick, if you will. It's all there. So go check that out. On the back end today, I am going to bust my favorite magazine for a conflict of interest that I caught. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, wanted to just let you know that we are heading towards the 200th episode. I have not gotten any ideas or stories or what have you. So it's probably not going to be a story of listeners based episode, but I do want your suggestions. One idea that Kate Mitchell, who helps me book the show, had is something like having two of some of the better guests that we've had doing sort of a conversation with each other that I sort of moderate or maybe be the interrupter or interlocutor of. So that's an idea. So if you guys are down or maybe interested in that, maybe you could recommend some of your favorite guests, and we can see if we can engineer that. So do give us your thoughts for what might be a fun 200th episode before it gets too late. Otherwise, it'll just be a regular guest episode. So we'll see where that goes. Oh, and one other thing before we get into the conversation, just wanted to remind you that the show I have curated that's opening at the Charlie James Gallery May 20th focus group is coming up very soon. Would love to see you there. So just want to give you a reminder, it's 7 artists. It's a range of work that is along the spectrum from the ambiguous to the didactic, which something comes from Nato Thompson's Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century, that guests that we've had on the show before. So I think you'll enjoy it. I'd love to see you there and meet you. I will probably be there starting at around 6:45 or so, goes till after, a little after 9. So come in that 7 to 9 range if you can. I look forward to seeing you there. All right, without further ado, let's get into the conversation with Anne Lindberg. Thank you for being here. Stick around on the back end for, again, for the bust of Conflict of Interest, one of my favorite things to do in the world. Talk to you then. You are in the Hudson Valley, River Valley, correct?
Yes, I'm in the Hudson Valley north of New York City, yes.
Do you mind my asking what the town is?
The town is Ankrumdale.
Ankrumdale. That's a lovely Hudson Valley kind of name, isn't it?
Actually, I should know the history, but I don't know the history. I'm in the Ankrum Township, which has three little towns in it, Ankrum, Ankrumdale, and Boston Corners.
That's so sweet.
And they're all tiny little hamlets,
right?
You know,
right.
All within 4 or 5 miles of each other.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
My limited experience with the Hudson River Valley is driving up there from the city many years ago, and the town I remember is Nyack. Is that anywhere near you?
Well, that's on the other side of the river, so New York's Yeah, you were probably driving up the thruway. I don't know if you were on an interstate, but that's on the other side of the river and quite a way south of here, actually.
Oh, okay. So you're like a good, what, hour and a half or so north of the city?
It's more like 2 hours plus,
oh,
actually.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And if you were to go up the Connecticut border, if one could drive exactly along the border, then
right.
you would just have to drive about 10 miles west to get to our house.
Right. Okay.
So, the state's kind of narrow as it goes down toward New York City, and we're on the far east side of that.
Okay.
But it's really the Hudson River Valley. It's between the Taconics and the Berkshires. So
mm-hmm.
and my movement around to get things during the week, I see both of those mountain ranges depending upon which direction I'm driving or looking. So
that sounds very, very pleasant and aesthetically pleasing, is it not?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, actually.
That's great.
It's pretty amazing, yeah. Sometimes I can't believe I get to live here.
That's nice. And to further orient us, because a lot of people will, especially New York area listeners, will be more familiar with the town of Hudson and Beacon and so on. How far away are you from that part of the Hudson Valley?
Well, yeah, Hudson and Beacon are probably an hour or more apart up and down the river. So Hudson is just a half an hour from here, and it's a town I go to for all kinds of services and activities.
Oh, okay.
So it's north and just north and west of here.
Right.
But I'm also sort of north and going east to Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
And what's there?
Kind of. It's about 40 minutes or 35 minutes, something like that. So it's kind of a similar distance, a little bit farther.
And what's in Great Barrington, Mass?
It's a really great little town. It's actually a really nice little town. There's great restaurants. There's an art supply store. There's a food co-op.
Right.
It's a pretty heavy residential area, and Tanglewood is near there. Some people are interested. There's a Waldorf school there that's quite famous. It sort of has a quality about it that is appealing.
So for lack of a better cliche encapsulation, it's hardcore NPR country, right? Sounds like.
Yeah, although you couldn't say that for the whole valley.
But
I think actually our NPR station, this is going to place me even more for people in the area.
Right.
Our NPR station that we get out here, which we get very few because of distance, is actually in Connecticut. So just south of Great Barrington, you would get into the state of Connecticut. And so Salisbury, Connecticut, I think is where our NPR station comes from that we listen to.
Right.
Because we can get that one. Hudson is very close and a very frequent place to go. Rhinebeck is also 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
Right.
There's like a hospital there and the dentist and stuff like that.
Right.
Beacon is an hour away.
Okay. So that's closer to the city, yes?
Yeah, closer to the city. And
right.
A lot of people probably know, and if my brother was here talking with us, he would give us a history, but the Taconic Parkway comes up the middle of this side of the valley on the New York side. It's a beautiful parkway with no billboards that was built in the Roosevelt era. And, of course, Roosevelt lived here, as you know, or may not know, in Hyde Park. That's a way to get – that's the way we go into the city if we drive, which we don't drive, but – you would go down the Taconic and then over to the river to get to Beacon.
Well, you know what the thing is that's really stuck out of what you just said is when you said the expression, no billboards, right? Because being in L.A., one of the worst culprits in the country, if not the Western world for billboards, it's a fantasy to imagine a place where there are no billboards.
Well, you have to go to Vermont to get more of that. And actually, I remember my aunt working in North Carolina in a city where they lived at one time on the city council working to try to minimize the number of billboards. It's an issue. But the parkway is pretty amazing. You know, it was during a time when the sort of car as leisure was a new idea, to drive a car for leisure. And the parkway is really amazing. Much of the time you're on it, it's two lane going both directions. Much of the time you're on it, you can't see the lanes going the other direction.
Right.
So it's been designed to give you this kind of German Autobahn feeling. There are no shoulders. There are very, very minimal shoulders. It's only 55 miles an hour. It's kind of you know, it's kind of narrow and not really windy, but it has a kind of roll to it that's really pleasant to drive on.
Right.
But it's a very particular design, and anyway, that's between here and Hudson, for instance. So I go over the Taconic and then into a slightly different landscape. It's a little more flat and fruit farms, like apple farms and peach growing and so on when you get toward Hudson. And then, of course, when you're at the river, it's something else. But
yeah. Well, I think I think the important thing here is you've established how quaint and lovely everything is up there. So the thing that I wanted to get to is since you're, you know, much further from the city than Beacon, for example, you're 2 hours, as you said. Does that kind of become a sort of, it becomes a bigger psychological barrier, so that while you could easily, you know, go down for the day or whatever to see a show and that kind of thing, I mean, how often do you find yourself doing that? And we should say, or you should say, that you've been there now, is it 2 years?
Yeah, a little bit more than 2 years.
Okay.
So the early part of 2015.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, I go into the city, it changes a little bit by season, but I would say about every 3 weeks, definitely once a month. You know, sometimes
that's pretty frequent.
Months when I go four times.
That's pretty frequent.
Yeah, and the routine has been to sort of go in for the day and come back on a late train. We do have an apartment in New York City where my husband stays when he's teaching there during the middle of the week. So I can stay overnight if I want to, but quite honestly, I oftentimes want to get back on the train and get back up here.
Right.
Because it's where my studio is. It's
sure.
where my thinking space is, and, you know, where I've chosen to be. So,
right.
But definitely it's fantastic to be able to stay multiple nights.
Yeah. And where does your husband teach?
Psychological barrier, but, you know, you wouldn't live here if you were going to, you know, commute to the city every day.
Sure.
Although,
sure.
My husband tells me he sees people that definitely do that. I can't imagine being on the train for 2 hours both directions every
harsh.
Day.
That is harsh.
That's crazy, but some people do it.
Right.
But you would, if you were wanting to be out away from the city, you would be, you know, down toward White Plains or
Westchester,
Chappaqua, down into Westchester County. Yeah,
sure. And
or in Beacon. I have many, many friends that live in the Beacon, Cold Spring area.
And what is your county? What is your county?
Columbia County.
Columbia County. Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
And I was trying to ask earlier, what does your husband teach and where does he teach?
He teaches lighting design at Parsons School of Design.
Oh, so he's essentially a fellow artist, or does he refer to himself more as a designer, would you say?
Well, he's a designer. He's a kind of a unusual lighting designer in that he went to art school. He has an undergraduate degree in art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, BFA, and he studied, you know, design and sculpture and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So he comes to lighting design from art, although he's very schooled as a designer, obviously. But lighting design is kind of a field that's between a lot of disciplines. It grew out of engineering and theater design and architecture. So, you know, it's kind of a hybrid field in and of itself.
Right.
So for him to come to it from art is a little more unusual, but it's not unusual to have, you know, people coming to lighting design from, you know, let's say optics or phenomenology or psychology or something else. So,
and what is this apartment like, and where is it that he stays at when he goes down and teaches?
We have a tiny little 300-square-foot little pied-à-terre, they call them.
Pied-à-terre,
studio apartment.
Right.
It does have three windows, which is kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, if you stick your head out the window and practically fall out, you look, you know, to the west, you can see the Hudson River. It hardens the view, but it's a great apartment. It's on the Upper West Side. It's an old hotel. It's just one room with a little kind of countertop kitchen over the corner and a bathroom.
Right.
But it's all one needs.
It's perfect for a crasher of a night or two.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Got it.
Yeah.
So the bigger subtext then that we're getting to about your being now in the Hudson River Valley is that you moved a little over 2 years ago from Kansas City. So, and you were there for 28 years, was it?
Yeah, I moved there in right at New Year's 1991 mm-hmm. and left in 2015. So
got it. Okay.
I guess you can do the math there.
Yeah, yeah. And where are you from originally?
I grew up in Iowa.
So you're a Midwesterner
through
and through.
Have you had a visitor to your podcast from Iowa before?
I think you were the first. I think you were the first as far as I know.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell us about Iowa.
I grew up in Iowa City, Iowa, where the university is.
Okay.
And my parents recently both passed away, and they, you know, lived there.
My condolences.
As long as I am old. I was born about a year after they moved there.
Mm-hmm.
My father was on the faculty of the university, and my mother was an artist.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's where I grew up. It was a pretty incredible place to grow up, actually.
In what way?
Well, these are sort of anecdotes that I've told before, but it's a small university town. It's a walking town. There's a river
right.
that goes through it.
Right.
The university is sort of nestled on both sides of the river and pretty integrated into the town and the neighborhoods, unlike some universities that are sort of, you know, campuses in a section of town. This is a very integrated situation. It has a really great history as with the Iowa Writers' Workshop.
Right.
And actually the Joffrey Ballet for many, many years, particularly when I was younger, was in residence there in the summer from New York. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a lot of culture. There's a high percentage of PhDs and mm-hmm. people who go to school there and then decide they want to stay because it's such a great town. It's a book town. It's a kind of a folk music town. And also it's a huge, you know, research university town, so people in disciplines of science, and there's a big medical school there and law school and engineering school and so on. So
mm-hmm.
is it
all
great
is it,
to live.
Is it
yeah.
also a pretty racially homogenous town?
Well, Iowa in general, I would say,
sure.
is racially homogenous. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you went to Kansas City, and I think without getting right into all of that story, I'm interested in what was it that led you to decide to leave and go to New York?
Well, it's interesting. Most of the time I was in Kansas City, I loved it there, absolutely loved it there, and really grew up there in many ways, and became, you know, really became the artist,
mm-hmm.
became an artist.
Right.
Began to make more mature work, and I learned about teaching. I stumbled a lot when I first started there, you know, stumbled in teaching and stumbled in making and
mm-hmm.
and becoming part of the community. But after 28 years, you know, I felt very settled there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there was a point about 10 years ago or maybe a little bit longer where both my husband and I began to think about, you know, like, what is the 20-year plan here?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was ready to, you know, I've always wanted to live in the country, actually. It's something I didn't do as a kid. I grew up in a college town.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of always had this sense that I would have an affinity to the pace and the people. And so when Derek took the job at Parsons, which was in 2005, quite a while ago.
Wow.
Yeah, so we were 10 years, you know, living between two cities, basically. He was the one moving back and forth more than I was.
Mm. Can you describe what that was like? I mean, how often would he come back, and how often would you go to visit?
He had kind of a routine of about every 3 weeks. He would come for, you know, come on Thursday and leave on Monday kind of deal.
Mm.
And then all summer and Christmas and other holidays and things. I think I went to New York City maybe a couple times a semester or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The plane ticket, and you know, it starts to add up.
Yeah,
but
and essentially,
his design practice going during that time, and you know, continues to do that. So he had need to go back and forth because a lot of his projects were Kansas City based projects.
But it was a long distance relationship for a while.
Yeah, it was. You know, it had its ups and downs. We don't have children, so that wasn't a complication.
Right.
And probably wouldn't have done it if we'd had kids.
Right.
That would have been not the right thing to do. But
mm-hmm.
I think of it as a really fruitful time in my studio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm somebody who's a really intensely, you know, really intensely, I'm in the studio on a daily basis, and I could really do that when you're on your own. You
yeah.
can organize your time as you need. And I think he feels that way, too. He hadn't really taught intensely before and, you know, plopped himself in the middle of New York City as a Midwestern kid and, you know, had a lot to learn. And So I think for each of us, he didn't go to graduate school, so I think those first years were sort of like graduate school for him.
Right.
Even though he was running the graduate program.
Wow.
But he, you know, I just think that time for me, at least, was a real focus in my studio, and so I'm grateful for it. But I believe that there was a period of time when we, you know, sort of said, obviously, this is not something to do for a long trajectory of a relationship and of life, actually. So it was pretty clear from the time he took the job in New York that we didn't want to live in the city or in Brooklyn. So we began to look.
Why was that clear?
I think just both of us wanting open space and
and not a 300 not a 300 square foot apartment.
Yeah, not a tiny studio, and not a lot of noise, and you know all the things that are great about New York, but also difficult about New York.
Right.
So we have a couple friends that live up here. One couple who raised their children, basically coming up here. They've owned their house for probably 30 some years.
Mm-hmm.
And we visited them, or we'd get a zip car and drive up and stay in a hotel and, you know, just drive around. Beautiful, and there's a lot of history. So I think the just repeatedly coming up the river led us to understand that this is a pretty great place to live.
Mm-hmm.
It's crawling with artists. I mean, there are artists all over this valley.
Yeah.
Quietly, you know, tucked away doing their work for the same reasons that we're here.
Right. I want to investigate that, but at first I want to ask you, I want to hone in on what you were talking about during that period when your husband was starting to work in New York and you had all that alone time in Kansas City in your studio and how productive that was. What is it about? So in other words, I guess what to just fast forward to the image that I'm getting, you're working in the studio and you're presumably, you know, ideas and the processes are sort of racing around your head or evolving in your head or however you want to put it. And somehow having your partner around maybe and talking to your partner maybe slows that process down, whereas when your partner's gone, you get to sort of continue to have those thoughts and those thoughts get to play out in a way that they didn't otherwise. Is that kind of how it works?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that having a partner slows it down. Mm-hmm. It just changes the way you can organize your day.
And, oh, okay. It's more practical.
And also, I think it naturally caused me to reaffirm relationships with other artists that I had that I could have conversation about work with.
Right.
I mean, I have deep lifetime friends from Kansas City who are still part of my life. So those other artists and people I taught with when I lived there were a big part of that time. I just think when you recognize that you've got your day ahead of you and there's no one expecting you to come home for dinner at a certain time or leave at a certain time or whatever, that there's a kind of freedom in that. Pretty great and, you know, also really hard.
Right. Yeah, so I see. So it's more of a practical thing. It's that you and did you have a pet during this period, by the way? Just that's kind of a another practical consideration.
I've had a cat pretty much for the last 20 years or so.
Right.
And I have one now. Yeah.
Have your cats been demanding, would you say?
No, I've always had really
low maintenance cats.
Sleeper, snuggly, fat cat.
Right, got
they're
it.
They're not crazy cats that require a lot of attention.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah.
So the area is crawling with artists, as you said, in the Hudson Valley. Is this something that you've kind of picked up both firsthand through meeting them, as well as I don't know, going to openings and just finding out that there's many more artists than you thought?
Yeah, it's kind of, you know, peeled itself open like an onion. Like I knew, of course, with the traditions of church and Cole and Thomas Cole and so on, that this is a place that artists have wanted to be. And And the town of Germantown, which is over near the river, kind of between Hudson and Rhinebeck, mm-hmm. has long mm-hmm. been a center for writers that came up, you know, in the 50s. Mm-hmm. So I knew that history, and the same kind of history exists in the part of Massachusetts near me as well. So mm-hmm. I knew that history, and also I also was very aware that after 9/11, a number of artists chose to leave.
Right.
As did many people in all kinds of disciplines. It wasn't just artists.
Yeah.
And so there was a movement in this direction at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was aware of that, and I knew some key, really well-known artists that live here. But
do you
want
really
to drop
any
names? Slowly. In the time we've lived here, I mean, there's a really great lecture series that happens at a public library in Rhinecliffe, which is a small community right on the river near Rhinebeck, mm-hmm. that an artist and a curator, Mary Kay Lombino and Ruby Palmer, run. One's an artist and the other's a curator at Vassar College mm-hmm. at the museum there. And they basically have two artists give a talk. I think it happens about six times a year in this library. And the first time I went, there were like 80 people there, and mm-hmm. they were all artists.
Mm-hmm.
Believe it. You know, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is
your community, yeah.
What? These are the people at the market that I'm standing next to
right.
buying my vegetables, and these are the people, you know, who have shows in great places, and it's been really great. I haven't met everyone, but
right.
I've, you know, sort of quickly learned that there are a lot of artists in the region.
You said that there's some well-known artists up there. Who would you like to mention of them?
Well, Martin Perrier lives right across the river in Accord.
Mm-hmm.
And Terry Winters is a mile away from me in Ankrum.
Have you done studio visits with him? Or with either
I haven't
of them?
Done studio visits. I've met Martin.
Uh-huh.
Malcolm Gladwell lives nearby. You
wow.
know, I mean, there are many, many others I could name. Ellsworth Kelly, of course, famously lived a little north of here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and then lots of, you know, contemporary artists as well.
Right.
But, you know, it's not really the specifics. It's really important. It's just you realize that some people... Well, I don't know. I want to say something that an artist friend of my parents said when I was young, and it stuck with me. And Mike Roberts said, there are just as many kind of artists as there are people,
mm-hmm.
which is such a wise thing to say. You know, we make the assumption that artists all are similar and have the same kind of beliefs, but it's really not the case. And so some people want to live in the country, and some people want to live in L.A., and some people want to live in Tokyo or, you know, or in Alabama or, you know, wherever. So,
yeah.
I think there's a type or at least a population of people that want to live in this kind of environment. And
yeah. Well, you know, that's a really interesting...
And reassuring. Yeah.
I was just going to say, that's a really interesting point to think about. I think, and this is kind of a weird maybe segue or tangent to that, I think some people in L.A., kind of want a little bit of both, which is one of the things that people may not know about LA. People who don't know LA, or, you know, artists who think about LA from New York or other parts of the country, think traffic jams,
traffic.
Right? Or what have
yeah.
you. But one of the things that I think some people have, not many, as far as artists, is that they kind of have a little bit of a suburban / semi-rural kind of home environment, and then they also have access to all the city things. You know, that's kind of,
yeah.
I think that's an objective of some. But that aside, what I really wanted to segue into from what you said is the access to living in these nice semi-rural with access to urban areas, neighborhoods, you know, I mean, along with the city, you know, with both the exodus from 9/11 and just generally with home rate increases over the years and everywhere and certainly the growth of culture in, you know, many of these Hudson River Valley neighborhoods, I can't imagine that there's any way of avoiding significant real estate, right? So what
yeah.
is that situation like?
Well, I can't really speak to prices and that sort of thing, but, I mean, we have 13 acres, and I'm surrounded by dairy farms, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not really in a neighborhood.
Right.
I'm really out. If you were in Hudson, you would be in a neighborhood, or you, if you were, I can't say for sure because every little town is a little different, but I'm in a pretty thick agricultural section of the county. So, you know, my closest neighbor is, I can see them, but they're like a quarter mile or half mile away. And many of them are farmers, or one's a veterinarian. There are two women that live across the valley who are off the grid, and one's a farmer, and they're a writer and construction worker. And, you know, there's, it's like quite a mix of people. They're contractors that live in the area, and so on. But, but yeah, I can't speak really to the economy. You know, it's, I haven't really gotten to know people super well enough to say, like, did you partly move from Brooklyn because you could have a bigger studio, or you know, the where the economics of it was better for you? Most of the motivations that I've heard have been more like, I want to have a garden, or I always thought I could have chickens, or you know, or I needed to focus on my work. You know, that's probably the most common thing I've heard, is it just gives me more time to focus in my studio. As opposed to the city, which grabs you, you know, takes you to things, and it's fantastic. And I know I'm missing a lot by not being in either Boston or York or Chicago or wherever. So I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to answer your question, but
No, I think you did. You brought up a follow up, which is, how has your transition from Kansas City together been financially, if you don't mind my asking? I mean, has it been essentially lateral, or is it more of an investment being where you are now?
Well, we worked up to this. You know, we set our sights on doing this and saved and saved and saved and saved. So it, I guess financially it's better in that what we've saved is now landed on something has value. And we also, at one time, Derek's lighting design studio had, you know, we had eight people, and there were six staff members, including the two of us. I do play a role in his studio. So, you know, we don't do that anymore. He works on his own and in collaboration with other designers. You know, the move was a kind of a clarifying change. Like, let's keep the things in our life that we really want to be there and focus on those things that are, you know, the choice at the moment of what we want to do, and not do the other things. And that had to do with possessions as well. We just got rid of tons of possessions, and, you know, so in that sense, it's been, if you call that financial, it's been a kind of clarifying process. And we also built a house and the studio, so we started from scratch, which meant that we, you know, designed the arrangement of the two buildings and the scale of the house and the studio to meet, you know, meet our needs. And it's pretty amazing to go through the process of designing a little house. It's a small little house, but and a big studio. But you know, that's an indication of what this is for. This is for working.
Were you renting nearby when you were building the house and the studio, or were you commuting, or how did that work?
Yeah, the construction happened with us not here. I mean, I came a lot, and Derek would take the train up or rent a car and come up and check on things. The person who drew up the plans, the architect for the house, was working on other projects in the area and was able, obviously, to come over and check on it. We had a fantastic contractor, but I didn't watch it day to day, so it was such a great treat every time I came to, you know, see things take form. I had a project in Boston that I worked at the time, and I was able to come to see it during that.
So
that was a little of a leap of faith.
Yeah,
to
I was going to say, you picked the right you picked the right man for your or person for your job.
There. Yeah, the contractor is fantastic, and it's very simple. It's not an elaborate situation, so it's, you know, it's very kind of streamlined with the same hardware everywhere and that sort of thing, where you don't have to be making day-to-day choices in building something. The studio is a Morton building, so it's a kit barn. Basically, it's a metal utility building.
Mm-hmm.
So that comes with choices made for you, basically. And it was, you know, it's one of those things where a team of people come with a flatbed with the trusses made, and it pops up in about 2 weeks, and then the siding goes on. And then we built out the inside to be
mm-hmm.
insulated with heat, and there's a bathroom and that sort of thing. But the choice about the studio, I think, created a little ease in construction that made sense for the fact that we weren't here to build it ourselves, which would have been really amazing.
Yeah, sure. So the other thing that I was going to ask you about that sort of raised is what that made me think of is, even though you moved, you were evolved in with your work and your career to a certain extent that being remotely located was not as big a deal. You know, you didn't have to go to the city. And I guess that sort of, and hopefully you agree with that. If you don't, let me know. But the other sort of question that brings up is, how important is it to cultivate, you know, people in your community, like going to those lectures, you know, that you talked about and sort of connecting with people there and getting studio visits from some of those people?
Actually, it's really important. There are lots of things I miss about not being in Kansas City, but the main thing I miss is I can't, and I'm going to use names that someone who's not from Kansas City won't know, but I can't, at the end of my studio day, go down to Dolphin Gallery and see my friend Scotty, who I've known for almost 30 years, and mm-hmm. another artist who runs a frame shop,
mm-hmm.
you know, and have a beer with him. I miss that. And so, not that I would want to do that every day here, because it would be a 45-minute drive, probably, but,
right.
But you know, those kind of connections where someone is aware of the rhythm of your work and you can talk shop and,
mm-hmm.
you know, have a kind of an artist-to-artist kind of conversation. I want that. And yeah, I think it's important. I feel the notion of community here is interesting because it's like a county.
Yeah.
It includes New York City, because a lot of people that live in this region have a lot of connections into New York City. They've most likely moved up from the city, or they've moved from Boston maybe, or some other place like me.
Mm-hmm.
But that idea of community is important to me. I mean, this as a place is increasingly, the notion of this landscape and this region as a place is more and more a part of my work as well. So, you know, I've befriended a woman who is the curator at the Thomas Cole Historic Site, and that's a really incredible relationship. She's not only a terrific friend and a great curator, but it's the Thomas Cole site, which is sort of like a deep history that's nice to be connected to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I have made an effort to seek out other artists in the area and have them to my studio and vice versa. And that's been really fantastic. And I kind of reflect and say to myself, I've almost had more studio visits in the time I've been here than I had the whole time I was in Kansas City.
Wow.
Yeah, it just wasn't. When I saw other artists in Kansas City, it would be at events or lectures or at a restaurant or over coffee. It wasn't as much studio to studio.
Right.
But somehow here, and I, that's not a criticism, it's just sort of the way it was or the way it is.
And what is the etiquette around setting up those visits? I mean, is it usually pretty organic and it's just like, oh, you want to, you know, exchange studio visits? Or have you had to be a little more aggressive or, you know, outgoing in some cases?
It's been pretty casual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in some cases, somebody is coming from some distance. And so it's nice to offer lunch and, you mm-hmm. know, maybe take a walk or,
right.
you know, someone's right. making an effort to come to this somewhat distant location, particularly if someone comes up from the city. I mean, I've had a couple of cases where that's happened and I'm picking them up at the train
mm-hmm.
and, you know, then it's a half hour drive to the studio and, you know, it's kind of a day basically.
Right. I was going to say a half day, but but it's more like
a day. Cause they're on the train for a total of 4
sure.
hours and
sure.
then you're here for at least 2, if not longer. So,
right.
In that case, it's really nice to make lunch and,
yeah.
and then also help people understand being here. And that might involve taking a walk, you know,
sure.
or somehow being not just looking at the work, but doing something in the landscape or something like that.
Were the people that you hosted that came up from the city or have hosted so far people that you got to know a reasonable amount, you know, because for them to make that kind of commitment, for them to be doing it just from having seen your work on your website or what have you might be a bit of a stretch, but I don't know.
I would say that the people that have come, I've either known before or through a friend, or they contacted me, you know.
Right.
I mean, I was in some shows on the East Coast where I got to know another artist, and she and I have exchanged, she lives in Cold Spring, she and I have exchanged a lot of visits, and mm-hmm. So it hasn't been a cold call situation where, or another artist might recommend, like, you know, to another curator, you should go to Anne's studio.
Sure.
And then you get to know them and
mm-hmm.
on. So, yeah, usually if it involves somebody coming up from the city, there's some longer-term conversation that's occurred
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
leads up to that.
Right.
Yeah.
So you mentioned just a little while ago how the location is affecting your work. So without getting, you know, honoring the audio format that we're in, without getting too much into the weeds, can you describe how the location impacts your work?
Well, I guess the thing, and particularly today,
okay.
The quality of light here really is extraordinary and very different than what I know from the Midwest. And I've said to a couple of people that, first off, the kind of amber gold, sometimes pink quality that's in the Hudson River School paintings really does exist and really does happen often here. And there's something about the ecosystem of the river, I think, the latitude, maybe the particulate in the air, it's hard to sort of, you know, it's somewhat scientific, it's
mm-hmm.
perceptual, but it's a kind, more of a kind of non-literal statement that I'm going to make, but I often feel like the light is coming at me from the side here. And this
That's
is sort of a, mm-hmm. you know, this is the kind of thing that's, if you know my work, you would understand why that means something to me. Because all of my work has a gradient in it and has a kind of quality of light about it,
mm-hmm.
inner light
mm-hmm.
in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sensitive to that. And, you know, I went back to the Midwest. I've been back a couple times for various projects, and particularly last summer when I was there in July, I was so aware of how the light is definitely from above and has a kind of crystalline clear, crystalline is the word I want to use, a kind of brightness,
mm-hmm.
kind of snappy brightness to it
mm-hmm.
that can occur on certain days here, but more than often it's a kind of amber. It's sort of like it has sunglasses on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that quality of light is really in the work. And
right.
it's hard not to let that influence you. I mean, I'm in an open landscape where I can see in a lot of directions, and I'm really aware of weather and cloud changes. And
mm-hmm.
I live right next to a wetland, which is such a measure of temperature. And, you know, the spring peepers are peeping at night now, and it's this amazing sound. And the bird situation, so, like, all of that kind of moment-to-moment changes in the landscape and the skyscape and lightscape, if you call it that, have really influenced me.
Mm-hmm.
The work has more and more of a kind of a quality of a field, a luminous field, than it has before. And there's more intense looking at color. And so, yeah, I would say it's definitely... it's definitely influenced me.
One of the things,
hard for it not to,
One of the things that I'd say about your work, without again diving into it too deeply, but just on a observational, practical level, that you use a lot of lines, a lot of vertical lines. It appears. Repetitive patterns of lines, and I just set that up because I wanted to ask you if your 2D work, because I know you do 3D work as well, but if your 2D work tends to be particularly labor intensive.
Yeah, I tend not to couch it on those terms. It's a kind of a moment by moment addition. It's a kind of a stroke. It's a movement of my arm that slowly builds up the work. I don't think of it as labor intensive. I think of it as it's just the sort of layers and matrix that are needed in order to get to the image I'm imagining.
Mm-hmm.
By building these kind of minute fine line by minute fine line,
I can
watch the little details slowly accrete, slowly build, and it can subtly. I can make subtle changes. So it's really about sort of paying attention on an intense level.
Right. So I think you're objecting to the term labor intensive because I would imagine it implies to you that you are just doing a lot of work over a certain or long period of time and that it's pretty repetitive, whereas what you're describing involves much more intuition, observation, and so on, that it's not not sanding something for 12 hours.
Yeah, although if somebody asked me, I think it's getting more to my character almost, because if someone asked me to sand something for hours, I'd be very happy.
Oh, interesting. Why is that?
There's something about just sort of tending to a surface and tending to a form that might be in that case. For me, it's a place to think and to pace and to breathe and to find the variation in. So I completely understand that what I'm doing there's a system. I'm working with an architect's parallel bar, if you allow me to speak a little bit to the process. I'm working with a quite extraordinary custom-made architectural parallel bar that's 10 feet long.
Oh, wow.
It's a kind of a nice story. There's an architecture firm in Kansas City that I continue to know quite well, El Dorado Architects. And one of the principals at the time heard me say, and I'm not trained in architecture, heard me say at an opening, I wish I could find a parallel bar that's longer than 60 inches, 5 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're that length because that's the span of your arms, and that sort of makes sense for an architect to only draw the reach, the full reach of their arms.
Yeah.
And he heard me say that, and he must have gone back to his partners and said, Lindbergh wants a long bar, and to the architect, to have an artist working with a parallel bar, I think is really interesting because the parallel bar is sort of a tool that's not very often used in architecture anymore. It's, AutoCAD.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a kind of probably a romantic relationship to this tool that they learned to use in architecture school.
Mm-hmm.
So they proposed, I give them so much credit, it was such a fantastic project, they proposed to design a drawing board for me that turned out to be, I have it with me here, it's a 10 by 10 wooden drawing board that's on an electric winch. I draw standing,
mm-hmm.
So the bar is vertical, and this board raises and lowers with an electric winch. And one of their designers basically designed and fabricated this thing, and we got a grant for the materials from an organization in Kansas City to support the project. And it's pretty fantastic. And then I gave them the first big drawing off the board as a kind of a trade for all their incredible effort. But it's a pretty, pretty fantastic thing that enables me to make drawings that are, bigger than my body, and immersive. In a way, the drawing board is like a landscape almost. It's a panorama of sorts.
Yeah.
So there's a system in that I'm using this tool that's designed to make straight lines.
Right, right, got it.
And unlike the architect who's taught to make the pencil line as consistent as possible and spin the pencil to keep the pencil sharp and so on, I'm sort of breaking all those rules and looking for variation.
Right. Well, I'm glad we got into the story of your architectural tool. That it's definitely good to geek out on that. But meanwhile, I think I realize that the covert objective whenever I raise the term labor intensive with guests is because I want to find out if that means you have a lot of time in the studio that you need accompaniment, like, and whether that is filled with podcasts or music, or you prefer the silence, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of changes day to day depending upon what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I do music. I don't listen to podcasts. I've found that I will, you know, suddenly look up and realize I've missed an hour of it. So I don't tend to do that in the studio. Many, many other people, I'm sure, do, and there are times when I would. But I tend to listen to music.
What kind of music?
Usually non-vocal. Non-vocal.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
not necessarily just
like
classical?
Along the lines of, I'm taken with certain Nils Fromm. I don't know if you know the German experimental pianist.
I don't.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's an example
mm-hmm.
of, you know, Philip Glass.
Oh yeah, sure.
Crazy, but and then all kinds of classical. I love Schubert.
Mm-hmm.
And
how do you?
There's no music in the studio. Just, you know, the rhythm of the making is a lot for me.
Oh, is that right? So sometimes you can just be into the rhythm of the making, and that's all you need. You don't need any sounds.
Yeah, although, you know, there are times when I turn on something and my body's kind of dancing or something, but
right.
It takes a lot of physical concentration as well as mental and optical concentration to do what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that it's a chore by any means, but it takes a lot of my full body to
right.
do it.
Right.
Because I'm standing and I take steps while I'm drawing, and
sure.
my hand has to have, you know, I have to have sort of control over the tools.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, I have some of those issues too. I mean, in a very different way,
yeah.
and I can, because of the positions I'm in, because I don't have a fancy articulated board situation or what have you. You know, I have to rest because, you know,
yeah.
it's carpal tunnel things, or, you know, it's shoulder things or whatever. So I guess sort of the other question is, as it is so physically and to some extent mentally exhausting or taking a toll, you know, is there a limit to the number of hours that you can do it in a given day?
Yeah, there definitely is.
Right.
And
right.
I'm in my 50s, so my body's starting to talk to me
right. Right.
in ways
right.
that it, and, you know, I've had actually a long history with arm fatigue issues. I worked in bookstores as a young person hauling boxes of books and, did some farm work as a kid, so I seem to have an ongoing sensitivity in my arm, so I can't do it. I take a lot of breaks.
Right.
Have a kind of stretching routine, but that's also good. It allows you to step back and take a look at what you're up to, because the drawings at the moment are sometimes 9 feet, so if you're right up against it, you can't see it unless you step back. So
right.
Yeah, and I tend to work on big things and small things simultaneously, so I can work on a drawing that requires that I stand, and then after lunch work on something where I get to sit and, you know, sort of shift things around. And then, as you know, as an artist, there's always, like, photo files you need to edit and
sure.
other things you have to do that don't, you know, that aren't the actual making of the work. So
right.
I
right.
tend to sort of mix up the day in
yeah.
order to allow my body to continue to do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you think you're...
I looked at your work, and I can see, given scale and the detail and so on, that you probably have really similar things you have to think about.
You can see...
reality.
You can see that in my through my work that I too, am taking a toll on my body.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's not evidenced in the work, but I can imagine, given what you're doing, that...
Right. Yeah. So getting back to you being an artist in the Hudson Valley... And these, I'm particularly, I think, drawn to the image of the artist talk that you mentioned. You know, when there are the 80 people, I'm curious to know whether if you have any idea if you're being curated into a future talk, or if that's yet unknown to you.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I've only lived here 2 years, so I've only know a handful of people.
Right. Right.
I will say that I came here in 2009 to the Oh My International Art Center, which you may or may not know. It's in Ghent, New York, which is, again, about 30 minutes from here. Everything's about 30 minutes.
Julia mentioned it. Julia mentioned it, yes.
Yeah, Oh My.
She didn't say where it was.
I was sent by the Charlotte Street Foundation that Julia works for.
Right.
The Charlotte Street Foundation has a relationship with Oh My, and one artist from Kansas City each year is a resident in this program, and it's juried in juried by the board of Oh My, the jury of Oh My, but there's a guaranteed place, at least for the foreseeable future, for a Kansas City artist to go, as there are guaranteed places for an artist from Australia and Israel and many, many other countries. So I was a resident for 3 weeks in 2009. It was a pivotal point in my work. I discovered some things that actually started the three-dimensional drawings in space at that residency. It was a really pivotal point of discovery. But I met a lot of people through that time, and the Oh My community is a big part of the people that I know here.
I see.
Sort of a place that's been a springboard for meeting other people.
Right,
It's a really great program. And they have Music Oh My, Dance Oh My, and now Architecture Oh My. So they have residency programs in a number of disciplines. They have an exhibition space and a sculpture park. And actually, I had a really wonderful opportunity to have a big solo show there when I first moved here. And coincidentally, the curator who organized it didn't know I had been a resident. It was a nice welcome to the area.
Right.
think a lot of artists saw that show, perhaps, and so had some sense. A lot of artists in the area saw that exhibition, and that's helped me, you know, connect with people and
that's great.
Get to know other artists.
Yeah, because otherwise, if you're on this 13-acre, you know, property, it's like it's all you can do to just to go to the edge of your property and you know, have a chat with your neighbor, right? Let alone you know, meet the artist in the neighborhood.
Yeah, but the thing that's really great that I feel like has become a whole new part of my life is there's a whole world of farmers in the area. They're pretty fantastic people. You know, charting a life on the land, and there's quite a number of people, young people, who are working small operations, totally organic, and one farm in particular is run by women, and they have music festivals and burger night, and, you know, it's not just a farm, it's like a place to gather and have the farm, the fruits of the farm, so to speak, be part of that event. It's a dairy farm. So that's a community of people that's really been great to get to know.
Yeah, I bet. And would you actually purchase some of what they grow, or, you know, eggs or what have you, directly from them, as opposed to, or in addition to, going to a local farmer's market?
Yeah, this farm, we get raw milk there, and we can get mint cheese. Her brother makes cheese. We've been a part of CSAs. Almost all of our food comes from this valley. It's pretty amazing.
That's awesome.
Actually.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That's something I also wanted in life, and it's pretty incredible. And the people that are making that happen are extraordinary citizens of this country.
I didn't
say enough about how great it is. And you know, carries on the tradition of what this valley's always been. If you go to the Green Market in Union Square, almost all of the farms that are there are from this valley.
Right.
So many of them are, you know, taking produce into the city, but also very, very much selling it locally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Anne, it sounds like you have a pretty sweet lifestyle up there in your new home.
Yeah, I feel, you know, I'm still a newbie to the situation, so I get tickled about it, but it's been good for my work, and I don't feel lonely. Some people come and say, wow, how do you handle it? But I think I'm a person that doesn't need a lot of social interaction, and it's so easy to go into one of the small towns and interact with people, or take the train into the city and, of course, be, you know, confronted with New York City when all of it has to offer.
Right.
So, and then projects that I do take me to other places, you know, traveling for shows and projects. So, yeah, it's a good situation.
That's great.
It's a good situation, yeah.
Well, yeah. I think I'm good. Are you good, Anne?
I think so.
Excellent. Yep. Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I appreciate your sharing your situation up there in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah, I want to tell you, I was in L.A. recently, a couple weeks ago, and had a great time, actually.
Oh, no kidding. What was the occasion?
Derek was giving a lecture, and I hadn't been to L.A. in a really, really long time, and so, yeah, I just saw museums and went to the Eames House and drove up the coast beyond Malibu and hiked, and we had a great time.
Yeah, it sounds like you do better stuff when you came to visit than we usually do, because we just take it all for granted, you know?
Yeah. One thing I will tell you that we did, we went to the neighborhood that Gregory Ain designed, A-I-N, their houses in the late 40s.
What neighborhood?
Gregory Ain. I think it's called
Mar Vista.
Mar Vista Tract or something.
Yes,
like that.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I live in Mar Vista.
Are you kidding?
No.
Interesting.
You're talking about those ranch houses that have a similar aesthetic.
Yeah, they're basically the same footprint that's been spun and rotated around,
right,
so they all feel a little different.
Yeah.
Designed by Gregory Ain. My brother is a preservationist and has done a lot of work in mid-century architecture work in L.A., and so he suggested we go there. It was really interesting to see.
Yeah, absolutely, it is. And I don't suppose you got to go inside any of them. You just got to see the outside.
No,
No,
we just walked
right.
the streets.
Yeah, it's a nice walk. Yeah.
Interesting.
yeah, that's a great one. Thank you very much again to Anne. That was obviously a rather weird fade out. We did talk a little bit more, and she did thank me. So just in case you're worried about that, she did. Thanks again. And so this is a listener-supported show. Before we get to the busting of the conflict of interest that I caught in the New Yorker magazine, I do want to remind you that this is an ad-free podcast, and it very much depends on listener support to keep the show going. So if you are a longtime listener, if you are a new listener, we really do depend on your financial support of the show to keep it going. Kate Mitchell does a tremendous job booking guests for the show. We both put a lot of time into it that is unpaid, other than your occasional contributions financially. So there are a couple ways you can do that. You can donate to the show now via Patreon, which is an ongoing way to support the show for as little as $1 a month. Though if you start at $3 a month, you will be eligible for the bonus episodes, 3 now and more to come. Or you can do a one-time $25 donation via PayPal. Both of those are linked through the website. You can support the show non-financially by becoming a fan on Facebook, social media, at Artist Podcast, leaving a great review on iTunes, which will help other people find the show. You can also spread the word, of course, and you can recommend me to other podcasts. I have somebody that's recommending me to another art podcast. I haven't heard back from that person yet, but hopefully it will happen. If you listen to a podcast where you think I might be a good guest, you know, I'd love to go on it, get more people to find out about the conversation before it's too late. All right, so here is the big bust, the conflict of interest. So there is a very dull and not particularly worthy institution called, and I'm going to be giving them free advertising here, but I don't think it's going to help their cause. They're called Quest Royal Fine Art LLC. They are based in New York City, and this is what their ad says. In the middle of the ad, it says in big font, "Be uncool." And before that, it says, "Ignore the latest trends. Defy current fashion. Time is the best critic. Seek art that is worthy of the ages, not the headlines." And then below, "Be uncool," it says, "Request our hardbound catalog of important American paintings. It is wise to be uncool." Well, first of all, it's one thing to be uncool. It's another just to have mediocre historic work that you represent, as seems to be the case with them. Mediocre landscape paintings and city scenes and whatnot. That's basically what they've advertised in the past. This one is all text. So I wouldn't get too bent out of shape about Quest Unroyal. What are they called again? Quest Royal Fine Art. And so that's on page 23, that advertisement of the May 8th issue of The New Yorker. And now I remembered that sounds, I thought I saw something in the magazine itself with that name. And so I went back to the Talk of the Town, the beginning section of the magazine, and I went to a little piece about the transport and the eventual sale of what's known as the Big Book. Not the Bible, actually, but the original manuscript that became the Bible of Alcoholics Anonymous that this guy Bill Wilson, a.k.a. Bill W., wrote. So it's got like all of his, you know, corrections and markups and so on. And it's estimated, I think, to go for a million, did it say? I don't remember what the exact, but it was a big amount. So anyway, at one point in the middle of that piece, it reads, "To promote the sales, Profiles in History is exhibiting the manuscript in New York later this month at the Quest Royal Fine Art Gallery," and was floating a claim from an AA historian, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a Talk of the Town piece by Nick Palmgarten, who contributes regularly to the magazine, both the Talk of the Town and longer features. In fact, he has written about contemporary art. He's written, did a profile of the dealer Leo Koenig and the mega dealer David Zwirner, which was a very good piece. So here's the question. Is this payola? Is this basically payola? Quest Royal is advertising the magazine, and the magazine is doing a piece in which they mention Quest Royal. You know, if it is, I don't want to make that big a fuss about it. It just seems unlike The New Yorker because they have such high standards. I did kind of thumb through the magazine and notice that there are very few ads compared to some of their issues in this issue. So I don't know, you know, if there's some connection there or what, but it's a little fishy. Wouldn't you agree? It's a conflict of interest, is it not? All right, so I'm done busting for the week. Just wanted to point that out to you. Now you are aware. Consider yourselves aware. And actually, this goes back to one of the teachings, the lessons that Nato Thompson talks about in Seeing Power, Art and Activism in the 21st Century. And speaking of which, some parts of his book were the inspiration for the show that I curated that is coming up very soon at the Charlie James Gallery. It is called Focus Group, 7 artists. The opening is 6 to 9 p.m., though I will probably be there more like 6:45 or so till 9:30, because I think they usually run past 9. So please do come. Please introduce yourself if we don't know each other. I would very much like to meet listeners to the show who I do not yet know in person. Thank you in advance. Thank you for being here. And I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.